I knew because of my Christian family. God, this isn't just occurring to me now, you know, the question, you know, how to live, when I set out when I was 17, at 50, I found it was the ground I'd always been standing on.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity. That is the magazine that sponsors this show and brings it to you each and every week. For our latest subscription deals, do head to our website, premierchristianity.com. You can check out all the latest articles we're publishing on a whole range of topics. If you enjoy The Profile, you are sure to love Premier Christianity magazine. Do head to premierchristianity.com/subscribe to take a look at our latest deals. You've joined us, though, today for The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian each and every week and hear something of their life story. Really pleased to introduce my guest this week on the show. It's Dr. Martin Shaw. He's a writer, a mythographer, and a Christian thinker, author of over 17 books. His latest is called Liturgies of the Wild, Myths That Make Us. And Martin told me, actually, just before he came on air, it's a New York Times bestseller. It's done incredibly well. Having read it, I can see why. There's some wonderfully profound stuff in it. I do recommend it, Liturgies of the Wild. But we are going to hear from Martin in a moment. You'll hear me get his title wrong. He's not a mythicist. He's a mythographer. So let's just set that straight. But you will hear me make that mistake in the first question. Without any further ado, let's listen in to my conversation with mythographer Dr. Martin Shaw. Thank you so much for coming in. I've got to start with the most obvious question, and you'll have to forgive me for this one, but what is a mythicist?
You've just created a word, a mythicist. There's a mythologist.
Okay.
There's a mythographer, but a mythicist.
A mythicist. A mythicist.
You have just made that, I think.
Oh, right. Wow.
But that's no bad thing, man, because actually, you know, people are always saying to me, mythographer, you made that up. The reality is a mythologist is somebody with a piece of paper attached. You generally have a doctorate, but it is simply somebody that's explored all the layers of an ancient story or a myth and is looking at it probably from an anthropological perspective, a cultural perspective, a psychological perspective, like layers of an onion, and can talk reasonably convincingly about all of them. The thing that I also do, though, that is really different to that is I am actually an oral storyteller. So I tell these stories sometimes for days, certainly hours at a time.
Well, thank you for correcting me. I've got it right here in front of me. Mythographer.
That's all right, yeah.
Mythographer. Okay. So as you mentioned, I mean, you've come at this from all sorts of different interesting angles. There's the personal element to your own story we're going to talk about. You've studied this, you know, academically as well. You are a storyteller as well. You know, do you often meet people like me who say, I've never come across this whole area before?
Yeah, all the time. However, I've never met anybody in the world that says, if there's one thing I just can't stand, it's a great story. So the confusion doesn't last long. There's usually a way in. And that's what I love, actually, about the phrase storyteller. It seems so benign. You know, you get access to all sorts of situations being a storyteller, but of course stories can be absolutely profound and life-changing.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, let's do your story. Tell me something, Martin, if you would, a little bit about life growing up for you. Where was it, and what were the sort of stories in your culture, in your life, in your family growing up?
We would go back to the year of my birth, which is a positively ancient 1971, beginning of the 70s. And I grew up in a place called Torbay, which is in Devon. And Torbay, sadly, has struggled a bit in recent years. But back in the day, I remember it. The glorious summers of the 1970s when all my cousins would come to stay. Loved it. So my mum and dad, who are still with us, my dad was and is a preacher. So we were going to Upton Vale Baptist Church that was being led by an amazing Scottish preacher at that point called Peter Barber. So the stories that I received as a kid were biblical stories, but also myths and folk tales, because we didn't have a car, didn't have a telly, didn't have a phone, but we had lots of books. And so as soon as I could read, I would often be told stories by my dad, read stories by my mum. As soon as I could read, I was padding around the place and nicking anything off the shelves I could. And so the composite mix as a child is lots of time in the small copse behind the house and lots of time with books. And in a strange way, nothing has changed.
I love that. You'll be aware there's an interesting conversation going on right now about books and reading. And we at Premier Christianity, we've just done a cover story on the 100 books that changed the church. And we did that partly because we are aware some commentators are really quite concerned about the kind of lack of reading. You hear about not just children's literacy going down, but actually us as adults are perhaps far more likely these days to scroll Facebook or watch Netflix than we are read a book. Is that something that concerns you? And do you agree that there is a worrying decline in literacy and with that a bit of a decline of interest in these stories that are so formational and foundational actually for us as a society?
Yeah, that would worry me. There's an American poet called Gary Snyder, and he says this. He says, books are our grandparents. And what he means by that, of course, is you may not be receiving great teachings from your immediate family, but in a book worth its salt, that is deep, handed-down cultural information. And also, a book requires concentration. It requires discipline. You set out at the beginning, you get to the end, and all of that is now horribly out of fashion. And we live in a à la carte kind of culture where we pick and choose what we want. When I was rewriting Liturgies of the Wild, one of the things my editor said to me, she said, don't expect many of your readers to begin at the beginning and end at the end. Every few pages, hold their hand a little and remind them of the steps we've previously taken, because they've probably forgotten or put it down or wandered off. Nobody wants to believe that as an author. You want to think you're so mesmeric. People, you know, draw the curtains and don't leave the house for a week. But things have changed and it is alarming.
Yeah. Yeah. So coming back to your story, you mentioned a Christian upbringing. So what are your memories of faith as a child?
My memories of faith as a child would be, if I think about the most dramatic was the charismatic movement. So that was real signs and wonders stuff in the early 1980s. I'm a veteran of something called Spring Harvest. Went to Spring Harvest a lot with my cousins, the Nicholses. Went to Greenbelt a few times. So I am pleased to say that I experienced, I was originally in a Baptist church, which was terrific, but a little bit more sedentary than that. But the charismatic thing, my goodness me, that was a Holy Spirit that seemed extremely active and was paying no attention whatsoever to where they should or shouldn't be. Stuff just happened. So that all goes on till I'm about 17. And like most 17-year-olds, you want something to kick at. And I thought, well, I'd like a break from this, thank you very much. And actually, it's then that the myths and the folk tales I loved as a kid reared back dramatically into my life and in a way took on a kind of spiritual resonance that for a lot of people religion occupies.
Mm. Yeah, tell me more about that. Because I think when people hear words like myth, it does sometimes conjure up, I mean, almost sort of pagan connotations.
Yes, yeah, yeah,
is
yeah,
that
yeah,
is that the sort yeah. of world you went into?
It's funny. I get this a lot, this notion of pagan. And pagan actually means a person of the hill. It's not a bad word to have, actually. It's a rural person is a pagan. But no, I didn't think of it particularly as a pagan thing. I just thought that they were incredibly vivid stories about the deeper implications of living. You think of Homer's Odyssey or the Iliad or the Arthurian tradition or the Irish stories of Finn McCool or Russian fairy tales. They're just dynamite stories. However, here's the interesting thing. There's no pressure to believe in them with the intensity that you get in a typical kind of evangelical setup. And actually, after a while, as a child, I was finding that really claustrophobic. People were wanting me all the time to have kind of a born-again encounter. And I'm a kind of introverted person and I have a deep sense of the interior. And I think I probably did have an instinct that God was talking to me, but it wasn't necessarily going to show its hand in the way that kind of church expects it to be shown. Yeah. And so what that means is even though I meandered for 30 years out there in the world of myth and story and wilderness rites of passage and all sorts of things, I never really lost the sense that there must be an intelligence behind this. I've never been an atheist or anything like that.
Yeah. So as a 17-year-old, you were leaving the sort of church background, maybe the charismatic background that you were in at the time. But it wasn't a rebelling against the idea of God. It wasn't becoming atheism. But it was a deeper appreciation and understanding of some of these ancient stories that held great and still hold great meaning for you.
Yeah, I think, if I'm honest, I think I had chapter and versed my way out of a dynamic relationship with the Bible.
Wow.
It was so unerringly the same all the time. I couldn't seem to get any protein out of it. And it didn't seem like great storytelling because the stories were already... The stories were locked and loaded by the priest or the vicar to make a point. Now, how would it be if, as Christians, we looked again at the Bible and said, maybe we should just let the stories be the stories for a minute. Maybe we haven't corralled them. Maybe actually there's a Holy Spirited intelligence in them still wanting to disclose themselves. But nobody did that when I was a kid. They just said, this is the story of such and such, and isn't, you know, it means this. It means this. Well, if you have a romantic heart and an imagination, then after a while this is a kind of a breathless world to be in. And it's kind of either that or you're speaking in tongues. So it's really interesting. You're either getting kind of very muscular sermons or you're having incredibly intense sort of psychoactive responses to the Holy Spirit. And I think I probably just had sort of hit the enough button. Mm. And it's not as if I didn't want to be a soulful person. And it wasn't rebellion, because actually it was really rather painful. My entire family are profoundly Christian. And my cousins are profoundly Christian. And it goes on and on and on. So to be a very loved black sheep for 3 decades is actually quite a painful position to be in. I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, sure. I love what you just said about you chapter and versed your way out of a dynamic living relationship with God. That is such a danger for all of us, isn't it?
Yeah. I often find, I've been saying this recently, there's an enormous influx of converts into Eastern Orthodoxy, which is what I'm part of. And it's a terrible thing if what you see happen is a very intimate encounter with what we would call the Holy Spirit or God. You go back 2 years later and they've become an expert on church history, and they're not where they were in that first moment. You know, we know with Christianity there's a kind of beginner's luck, where people can have like words of extraordinary inspiration, and they have no theological makeup, but they're connected to the living flame of the stories or to God. So I'm trying to be wise as a serpent about that, and hold clear to the things that I think I really need to hold on to.
I'd love to talk actually about age 23, if that's okay. Because age 23, you go on a wilderness vigil in Wales.
I did.
Tell me that story.
Well, I, by now, believe it or not, I got married when I was very young, and I married a wonderful woman, but I wasn't so wonderful myself at that age. So the marriage didn't last very long. And I ended up living in a men's hostel in Twickenham. I'm still a drummer. I'm a musician. I've got a record contract and everything.
Were you in a band?
Yeah, whose name shall remain nameless.
I've noticed in all of your writing and interviews, you never give the name
of the band. I'm a bit indistinct.
You just say that you are a professional and successful musician.
And I actually, as the books come out, I would query slightly successful. successful in the sense that I had a 3-album publishing deal with Warner Brothers. So you're a working player. You're a working player, and it had taken a long time to get there.
Can you say style of music?
Yeah, it would have been absolutely ferocious punk rock.
Wow.
Ferocious punk rock. It would have made Motorhead look reticent. It would have made Motorhead look like Caught and Sparked by Joni Mitchell. So I was in a fairly kind of harsh environment. You know, it was mosh pits and stage diving and skateboarding and wild stuff. which I remember quite fondly. But what it did do is it trashed my ears. I've had tinnitus for years. So one of the things that pulled me out of music was the ringing in the ears. However, so I end up going through a divorce. I'm living in this men's hostel. I have a phone call. We don't have phones in those days, but it was a red phone like a phone box. Talk to my friend Gavin, and Gavin says, I'm going to go and do something called a vision quest up in the mountains of Wales. It'll change my life. It's 4 days and nights without food. It's something that cultures have done all over the world when you're preparing for adulthood. And I somehow, some primal part of me said, I think that's the best idea I've ever heard. And he said, well, there's one place left. So I contacted a man called David Wendelberry, and I had that encounter up in Wales. Now, I would have been no more prepared for that than I would imagine probably your dear self. So I turned, I'd barely put a tent up. I'd struggle with making a fire. I remember turning up with leather trousers, which I still think about. Leather trousers and Converse boots, you know, hair to my waist. But anyway, what actually happened was a profound sort of unshackling from my identity as a musician or as a modern person in general, and a really strong encounter with, you know, the landscape of Great Britain. And then coming back from that encounter, the only thing that made sense to interpret it was these old myths and stories that literally are kind of embedded in landscape. So when I was fasting, I was looking out at a big hill called Cader Idris, the seat of Arthur. And of course, when I came back, I wanted to learn Arthurian stories to storify this great change I'd gone through.
Wow. Amazing. You mentioned fasting. You were fasting during that time.
Yeah. You fast for 4 days and nights. You drink plenty of water. Interestingly, it's not a sort of, you don't hallucinate or have mad. It's nothing like that. It's just an emptying out. And actually, as someone that now has led, I've now led these things for 30 years, if somebody after a couple of days says, look, they'll send you a note, you know. They'll say, it's okay, but I'm really lightheaded. That's fine. We just bring in some, you know, I'll leave some tangerines and some trail mix. It's not a macho type of activity. However, what the early Christians knew is we are a culture addicted to feasting and very, very bad at fasting. And as we start Lent, that's one of the, I'm sitting here hungry with you now because I've only had a tiny bit to eat today. So interestingly, fasting, a relationship to the world. This is all Irish Christianity. I just didn't realise. I didn't have a name for it.
Right.
I even lived in a tent for 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I lit about 1,000 fires in that tent over 4 years. And I learned a folk tale every time I lit the fire. So I had a lot of stories in my head by the time I'd ended.
Wow. And those 4 years, was that quite solitary?
Yes and no. I'm incredibly reluctant to paint too romantic a picture about it. But I did spend, you know, there was no phone, there was no screens, there was no laptop, there was no electricity. I was under canvas in a circle for 1,000 nights. I had a cat. I had friends that would come in and look for me every now and then. So I was still in the world. I do part-time jobs and things like that. But ultimately, yeah, I was in a very unusual position.
Yeah. What did your friends make of this?
I think probably a bit of a mixed reaction. I find it quite hard to imagine now, 30 years on, I think, who was that kid? You know, what? That takes a bit of explaining. I was doing a fairly, I was doing an American live event the other day, and the fellow interviewing me was saying, what on earth did your parents think? And actually, I suppose because my dialogue with my mum and dad has always been so good, they sort of understood the underpinnings of it as a kind of romantic bit of exploration that I was doing in my 20s. However, if you think about being, you know, I would have been about 28, I think, when I really embarked on that, although I'd been living kind of outside for a while. That is not normative behaviour. Mm. Most of my friends had gone to university. They'd got good degrees. They were now working in this new technology called IT, you know, and living in Leytonstone and places like that and doing that and having families. And I was this remote, slightly heartbroken, apprentice bard living on a hill on the Welsh border. Quite honestly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So for, I guess for a long period of time, you know, I assume during this time you weren't that connected to Christian faith.
No, I don't think I was, but I wasn't anti it either. It would be a much more exciting story if it's like, well, then, of course, I entered the Church of Satan. But I didn't do any of that. I didn't do any of that. I would have been romantic. The best way to describe me at that point, actually, is in the depths of C.S. Lewis's first prose book, The Pilgrim's Regress, where you begin to get near the Christian thing through the romanticism experience. And I'm definitely a romantic. I'm a Christian romantic, really. It wasn't alive for me, I must confess. It wasn't alive. I remember thinking, well, that's one thing I won't have to think about again. Mm. Ho, ho, ho.
What kind of brought you out of the tent after 4 years, and what came next?
A child. A child. The great blessing of my life is my daughter. And I fell in love, and I recognised that, wonderful though this period of time in the tent was, I felt it was going to be an extremely strong flavour for a little Western kid to grow up in. And if she wanted to have a life like that when she was older, I wanted her to have the option of it rather than make her feel even more marginal than she was already going to feel by having me as her father. So we moved into a little cottage on Dartmoor in the west of England. And that's what did it. It was another kind of initiation, which is an initiation most of us, if we're lucky enough to have it, it's the one into being a parent, you know, the great tempering.
Yeah. Dartmoor is important because Dartmoor is also where you went on this forest retreat for 100 days.
Yeah, much more recently.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because I think this helps explain and fill in some of the blanks of just your spiritual journey in particular, because this was a really important moment for you. I think, you know, reading about it, you had a really dramatic spiritual experience at the end of those 100 days. So just tell us that story.
I did. I've told it so many times now that sometimes, if you've ever seen a radiator, water starts to drip out of the bottom of it, which means it needs help. It's getting to, I'm becoming the watery radiator. So let's fast forward. I've given you a snapshot of me in my 20s. I'm now a grizzled older fella. I'm in midlife now. I'm almost 50. And I suppose I was looking back rather nostalgically at those earlier days. And I thought, oh, I've been reasonably successful. I've written books. I've got a house. I've been a professor. I made a living out of something that seems absolutely impossible to make a living out of. But at the same time, it's all becoming a bit easy. It's a bit dead. So what I decided to do was not fast for 4 days and nights, but go to this forest for 101 days and sit quietly at dusk every night and contemplate and pray and be still and tell a few stories. I know people think it sounds strange. What do you mean tell a few stories? No one's there. Well, trees are there, cormorants are there, the river is there, God is there, animals are there, owls are there. It was in some sense, this is a very poetic phrase, so forgive me, in some way I went to the forest to be re-wedded to the wild, and I felt I was losing that. What I never expected was to become wedded to Christ, which is actually what happens. On the last night, I go out for an all-night vigil, and in the middle of that night, I make it clear. I just suddenly had an instinct to pray, and I said, look, God, creator, I think I'd have probably used, if I am I'm a small wounded bird, I know I am, but I am here, and I've been here because I need to know how to live these years I have left, God willing, let them be many. If there's anything you want to show me, right here, right now, you have my full attention, Lord. And at that moment, a star just fell out of the sky. And it fell, it took about 30 seconds, this thing, and it just fell about 15 yards to my right. And as it fell, it changed colour. It went from a pale colour into kind of the purples and the greens and the whites of the aurora borealis. It took on the shape of the tip of a beautiful painted arrow. It was the most astounding thing I will ever see, I would imagine. I think this is my Bethlehem moment, do you know what I mean? I went back the next day, couldn't find anything. You know, the ground wasn't scorched. It was all completely silent. I wouldn't mind in the least if somebody that knows about such things said, on that night, we've looked at, you know, there was, you know, it's a biological or it's something to do with whatever. The point is, it happens at that moment, under that kind of intensity, after 101 days. That was a profound thing. And what I remember was scrambling to give it any kind of context. And I remembered the Old Testament dimly. And I remembered that God used to speak to people through events very similar to that. But what was happening here? I mean, does this mean that I'm... Is this a miracle? What's happening to me? I don't know. So I go back to my cottage. I stay out all night, which I find hilarious now, because to be honest, if that happened to me now, I'd probably go to bed straight after. I think that was the peak. But I pushed myself out for another 5 or 6 hours, come back to the cottage, and then as I'm falling asleep, just to kind of coup de grace the whole thing, there's these 9 words, inhabit the time and genesis of your original home. They just appeared in my eyes. They just filled...
Inhabit the time and genesis of your original home.
Okay. Yeah, which is a very weird... If it just said inhabit the time of your original home, that's one thing. Inhabit the genesis of your original home. So there's a weird bump in the sentence. It's very strange. I've been puzzling on it ever since, and I don't really want to know quite what it means. But it was enough of a provocation. It was a spiritual provocation. And the word genesis alarmed me because I thought, hold on a minute. What do you mean? There's only one book that the word Genesis comes from. It cannot be from the religion of my childhood.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
Then I went through lockdown. It took about 18 months of processing the thing. And then through a series of dreams, actually. And a kind of... So I think about it now, it's just as if my actual consciousness just started to kind of announce inevitably that this wasn't just a random spiritual encounter. This wasn't just a random aberration in nature. This had a kind of Christian choreography and a shape and a texture to it. And then at the same time, I was reading the Gospel of Mark, and I thought, well, that sounds awfully like something actually happened. It sounds like a report. Doesn't sound like a myth in the sense of a big flamboyant story. It was too scuffed for that. Mark is too scuffed. It's too strange. And I think pressures arrived from a variety of angles. And suddenly, just before my 50th birthday, I just sort of fell into the realities. As Paul says, I fell into the mind of Christ. And there was a terror in that. There was a reluctance in that, and simultaneously there was a kind of euphoria.
Makes total sense to me. I think most people will identify with that. It's been called the cost of discipleship, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And at the same time, we're promised life to the full, and you know, eternal life, and it's both, isn't it? I suppose that there's so much to this which is fascinating to me. One of them for you is the culture and the kind of context of your work life and your family life and friendships. There must have been a bit of a cost to that in, and even for you personally, really the religion of my childhood, going back to that which I left behind. Just tell me more about that wrestle, and maybe how other people perceived it as well.
The other people were generally not terribly impressed with this, and it was seen as baffling, because actually in the West, from a secular perspective, we're not really privy to the enormous spiritual dimensions of Christianity. We've inherited, I would say, and I say it respectfully, but I have to say, I think we've inherited an extremely sort of extroverted expression of Christian experience in the West, especially in the kind of very well-meaning and powerful evangelical circles that I grew up in. There were some amazing elements to it, but this, what I call the deep interior of the Christian experience, the contemplative, the hermetic, I just wasn't familiar with that. And so the thing that baffled me was I thought, there is no way I can sit in the pew in the kind of... I've seen too much, I'm afraid. I've seen too much to be back in there singing from that hymn sheet. So then what begins is a period of going from denomination to denomination. You know, I had a powerful experience at Bovey Tracy Baptist Church, really fantastic. I had an interesting experience in a local Catholic place. I don't know what to make of the Church of England at the moment. So I thought, oh, I'm going to have to give that a bit of a steer. Although some of the most wonderful people I know actually are Anglicans. So don't take that personally if you're listening. But then finally, I wandered into a church of Russian tradition. I turned up in an Eastern Orthodox church and sort of instantaneously just was transported by something called the Divine Liturgy, which is the oldest form of communion that we have, really. And we've been doing it in the shape that we do it in for an extremely long time, many, many hundreds of years. And what I loved about it was that nobody paid any attention to me. There wasn't a sort of an altar call. There wasn't any checking in. There wasn't a donut. There was no electricity. You know, there was none of this. And actually, however, sensorially, it was very beautiful. And I'm a creature attracted to beauty. And so also the icons were really interesting to me. And I think part of my kind of evangelical background, I was like, well, what's an icon? Is that, what do you mean? Are you worshipping the piece of wood? Of course, what we forget is the power of an icon often comes from cultures where people can't read. Right. So they're not reading the Bible, but they can look at an icon and go, oh, that's the road to Emmaus. That is Lazarus. And that's why we have all... If you've ever been into an Orthodox church, it's incredibly filled with beautiful stories and the saints as well. And so anyway, I found a home. Mm. And I was something called a catechumen for about a year. They check if you're serious or not. It's a very unhurried process. And when you ask them, they say, look, we've been here since AD 33. We're good. You know, we'll just see what happens. And they didn't even... Do you know what's so fascinating? My priest told me, I said, what do you want me to do? He said, a copy. I said, what do you mean? He said, come in and we don't need you to demonstrate, you know, great spiritual ecstasy all the time. But I want to see that you have brought into the physicality of your body the life of being an Orthodox Christian. And that means kissing icons, it means prostrations, it means fasting, it means feasting on occasion, it means rubbing up in the indignity of a small community of Ukrainians and Russians and English, and living in the tension of all of that, and knowing that every Sunday heaven and earth meet in this thing called the Divine Liturgy. Now, as somebody that has a longing for mystery, although Orthodoxy, I'm really pleased to say, gives you very, very clear directions about how to live as a Christian, outside of that or around it, you get a sense of enormous imaginative possibility. And as somebody that is an artist and creative, I have felt surprisingly free in that tradition. When I saw it from a distance, I thought, oh, I don't think I'll ever end up there. That looks like a lot of beards and a lot of rules and where are the women and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, these churches are basically run by women. But you don't realise that until you're inside.
Yeah, fascinating. You mentioned walking in and I think the communion liturgy, yeah, particularly captivating you. Just for those who haven't experienced that and don't really have a reference point for that, tell us some more. I mean, I guess the first question is, was this even happening in a language that you could understand?
Yes, it was. Because of the mixed congregation, you know, the mixed nationalities, it was a combination, I suppose, of Slavonic and a lot predominantly English. But what I realised immediately, most of it's sung. So there are readings and there are psalms, but it's being sung by a choir back and forth with the priest or the deacons interjecting here and there. They may give a reading. And I had just enough knowledge of the Bible to think, oh, okay, I know what's going on. This is a sung theology. Isn't that gorgeous? This is being sung. And actually, the liturgy itself is a very, very slow form of dance that takes place over several hours. One of the things that can be unusual is a lot of people will remain standing. So there's a physicality to that. That can be tough country in the second hour. But on the other hand, there's lots of chairs. You can sit down if you want. But it's not pews. You don't walk into a church with pews. It's a long, slim corridor with lots of icons, lots of images, lots of holy smoke, and a priest who a lot of the time, if you're lucky, there's something called an iconostasis or a rood screen. So some of it is visible to you, the ceremony, and some of it isn't. I just found the whole thing overwhelmingly moving, and to a point where actually I would recommend, if anybody's going to Divine Liturgy for the first time, get somebody else to drive you, because you may lose the capacity to drive for a bit afterwards.
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't make it. I drove through a green light. All the cars were honking, a red light, actually. All the cars were honking at me. And I said, I've been to church. And I got in. I had to lie in a dark room because I'd had an encounter. Wow. I'd had an encounter not with just a church that I took to, but a ritual that seemed to open a door in my own consciousness all the way back to Bethlehem, but sort of seemingly beyond Bethlehem through the Bronze Age stories of the Old Testament, further back and further back. I think of that line of Jesus's, you know, before Abraham, I am. I hit something immeasurably ancient in that experience. And they always warn you. They say, if you go to Divine Liturgy more than five times, you're probably in. And sure enough, I was.
It's so interesting. I mean, on one level, Martin, you might say, well, this is exactly what I might suspect or predict, because you are so well versed and so interested in ancient stories. Mm. Well, of course, you're going to find a home in one of the oldest, arguably one of the oldest denominations that exist. I know such things are probably contested, but certainly Orthodox go back a long way. Was there a sense in that for you of actually this is just kind of the person God's created me to be, that I love the ancient, I love the storytelling, and Orthodox churches just seem to do that in a way that makes sense to me and the way God has sort of built me?
Yeah, you know, there's many, many mansions. It was just a relief, because I thought, oh, I'm going to be a dreadful fit in a lot of these churches. Although I met lots of kind group people. And as I've said, I'm not really a fan of sectarian Christianity. I don't like pointing out when people are in error left, right and centre. I don't get a kick out of that. The world is destructive and deranged enough without Christians turning on each other. Mm. And I have not found all of the Orthodox experience going down particularly smoothly. Mm. There's lots that I struggle with. There's lots that I have to think about. There's lots of things that I'll circle back. There's probably things that I'll never be quite reconciled with. But the thought of being anywhere else as a Christian is absolutely unthinkable by now.
Tell me a bit more about a trend which is arguably happening here. I've read reports that have suggested that this isn't just you, that many other people, particularly young men, are seemingly drawn towards Orthodoxy. Like, has that been true in your experience? Are you witnessing that in your own church and other Orthodox churches, that actually, contrary to what some have assumed, certainly if we go back to your evangelical Baptist childhood and teenage years, and some of that thinking still exists today of, well, the way you get young people into church is smoke machines and guitars and drum kits. And maybe that's true for some churches. But equally, it seems there's another route in for particularly a lot of young men at the moment, which is through mystery, history, tradition and Orthodox churches. Can you speak to that at all?
It's certainly happening. It's certainly happening. And there's two completely different ways of sort of thinking about that. One could be that in the advent of YouTube and the advent of lockdown, people had lots of time to look at videos of people with the kind of charisma of Jordan Peterson and think, oh, okay, there's a kind of... Because I always associated churches really as the domain of women, you know, and I mean that in a really lovely way, actually. I'm very fond of them and I admire these women, but I didn't always see a place for, you know, a strong young man. And somehow Orthodoxy there's just a way in which they can feel useful and there's stuff for them to do, and it's actually quite hard to stand up during a service. It has a hint of the chivalric code to it, you know. And so on the one hand, yes, there's young fellas turning up in my church all the time that weren't there before. You can argue that they're coming from YouTube and they're inspired by that stuff. But I would also, I think that it's more mysterious than that. And I think that God is in the house. And just when you think the whole thing's over and we're, you know, packing up the big tent revival, then he pulls yet another move. And I think we're bearing witness to that right now.
Yeah. It's been called the Quiet Revival.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think you say that the whole Jordan Peterson YouTube theory is a very interesting one, that young men, they kind of crave role models. They don't mind a bit of discipline, doing something hard like standing up for 2 hours. And there's something in the faith in general, but certainly in Orthodoxy, that people are kind of rising to the challenge of it almost.
Yes, we want to rise to the challenge. We want our legs to totter with the vocation of what we're up to. I haven't said, just come back from America. I'm also pleased to report, though, it isn't just lots of grim-faced fellas frantically growing beards as quickly as possible. There's loads and loads of women of all ages and dispositions, and they haven't checked their brain in at the door. There's a place, of course, for the feminine, but I would say for men and for women, Orthodoxy, and the clue's in the name, really, of course, there is a place for deep investigation of the feminine and the masculine and the whole business of raising children well in this world. It's a good place to have a family.
There you go. Well, I mentioned the new book. It is out now. It's doing incredibly well. It's called Liturgies of the Wild, Myths That Make Us. And Martin, you were telling me just before we came on air that you are delighted by how well it's doing. I think you were saying New York Times bestseller?
Yeah.
Does that come as a pleasant surprise, is it?
Pleasant isn't the word, really. It's just like a glass ceiling suddenly dissolving over your head that you just thought, well, I know what those words mean when I read it. You know, the New York Times bestseller, blah, blah. You've got that for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
That's it, you know. So I didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
I'd made no space in my imagination for that, not for one single second.
Well, I'm reading it at the moment and getting a lot out of it, so I'm not surprised it's doing well. I'd love to read back to you, actually, just a short section.
Please.
And get your take on it. This is early on in the book, and you're talking about how we define myth. And you say, I could tell you that myth is a beautiful lie that tells a deeper truth. I could tell you that myth never was and always is. Mm-hmm. I could tell you that myth is truth without the use of facts. But actually, no. Even those diminish it, make it smaller somehow. After replying thousands of times to the question, I will just settle with what I said at the beginning. Myth is a sacred story. And some of the most sacred of those stories circle around the tale of a dying and resurrecting king who carried a great burden for his people and turned that burden into an extraordinary act of love. And some of us believe that the most sacred story crash bang walloped into the kind of time we can all register, ours. Myth collides with history.
Amen.
I mean, like many sections of the book, there's pretty profound stuff we could spend a long time kind of reflecting on. But can you just help us think about that? For Christians who have never really thought about this word myth, you seem to be saying that, I think as C.S. Lewis spoke about, that there are these true myths, and there is this almost ultimate story or ultimate myth in the person of Jesus through which all other stories flow. Have I understood you correctly?
You have understood me. That's a very good synopsis. We seem to find that all over the world there are stories with this particular rhythm in them of, you know, tremendous sacrifice, death and resurrection. Always as an act of love, always an act of service for something bigger than your own ambition. And we find this all over the place. And some people are sort of disturbed by that, but you shouldn't be disturbed by it. It's God speaking to all the cultures that he possibly could in the thousands of years before Jesus turned up. It wasn't dormant. We're not all being shoveled into hell. You know, it's a very beautiful thing. I'm with Augustine. All truth is God's truth. Relax. It's okay. Mm. However, what then happens is that motif is writ spectacularly large with great prophetic abundance 2,000 years ago. And, you know, people say to me, they say, well, Dr. Shaw, you know, you're clearly a sophisticated character. It's wonderful that you have this symbolic and mythic relationship to Christianity. Wouldn't it be awful if people think that you actually literally believed that he came back from the dead? And I said, do you really think I'd be wasting a second of my time on this if I didn't literally believe that he came back from the dead? Why bother? I'd scoot off and become a Sufi or just do something else with my time. The reality is, if you read the Acts of the Apostles, there's a commotion going on. People do not risk their lives for something that they know is actually a ruse and they was never seen again. I don't believe a word of it. And so actually, there is something genuinely disturbing. I don't find Jesus massively reassuring. And people think I'm being rude when I say that, but I'm not. But he's calling us for a deeper kind of life. And I knew, because of my Christian family, I knew there was going to be consequence for that. But if you've set out on a quest, as I had when I was 17, gosh, isn't it just occurring to me now, you know, the question, you know, how to live, when I set out when I was 17, at 50, I found it was the ground I'd always been standing on.
Wow, that's incredible. You also write in the book that churches are emptying because we forget the epic story we are tuned for. You say the adventure has somehow got lost. Irony of ironies, Christianity is regarded by millions of people as safe, boring, and pedestrian. Mm-hmm. Can you just speak to how we can help change that? Because I think Christians will hear that and think, well, I have a living and active and joyful faith and it makes the world of difference, and I don't think my faith is, you know, safe or boring. But they would also completely agree that that is often how we're perceived.
First of all, I would please anybody that's listening, that it's not worth being provoked by me in this. If genuinely in your deepest heart and your deepest truth, you really are living a vibrant Christian life, then fair play to you. I'd have no, you know, of sinners I am the first. So I appreciate that. But I do think somehow we're letting the story down. I do think that we're telling it in a rather sort of tranquilized type of fashion. I've said this many times, but I'm going to have to say it again now. We have a God that has a dog in the race called Jesus Christ. That little dog is born as a fugitive. He's born in a compromised position. He lives this strange, thin-skinned, mind-blowing life as a storyteller and as an exorcist. He then he's broken to pieces as an outlaw. And then, in the ultimate trickster move, and a trickster not in the negative sense, but in the mythological sense, he has the audacity to come back. This is incredible. This is absolutely spellbindingly weird. And that, I do feel, is not front and centre in a lot of churches on a Sunday morning. A lot of other good qualities are, but I just think there's a few of us probably that need to do that. That's all.
Yes. Well, it's a lovely short but profound way of retelling the Jesus story in those words. For someone who hears that and thinks, yes, that is an amazing story, but, you know, what does it have to do with the way I live my life? You know, I don't go to church, I'm not a Christian, you know, I just try and live a good life and treat people well, and, you know, fine. I want to, like, park the Jesus story over here. What's your response to that?
Well, you're being kind of blighted by good works, really, and there's a limit to good works, we know, as Christians. So, in other words, you know, the Tom Holland, in his wonderful book, Dominion, does a great job of saying, look, we're cultural Christians. We are. But that's a horizontal experience of Christianity. The vertical, you don't get the cross, you see, with cultural Christianity. The cross comes with the verticality of a relationship to something that is bigger and more profound than yourself. And that's not just a value system. That is a being that stands in and outside our universe. Mm. cosmic Christ. We would all benefit from getting our minds blown a bit, I think, and looking up at the night sky as I did 6 years ago. So be careful. Well, this would be my advice. Be careful, somebody, the imaginary person. Even if you think you're a cultural Christian, well, that's a hide. That's not an animal. That's just good works. Yeah. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate the influence and the civilizing instincts of Christianity. But have a really, really good look at Jesus again. And you'll find you can't draw him with one line. He's much more mysterious than that.
A part of your life that we've not had time to talk about at length is when you would take people out into the wilderness and help them in various ways. But I wanted to come back to that idea because we've spoken a couple of times about you, whether it was 100 days in the woods or the 4 years living in a tent. Do you still do things like that?
Yeah, I do. And in actual fact, come August of this year, I will go out with six Christians and do something called the Peregrini Sit. The lovely Celtic word for a Christian is a Peregrini. And that's got a bit of, so, you know, Christian is a word that was put on us. We were just people of the way.
People of the way.
Yeah. But a Peregrini is wonderful because there's a long walk in that word, peregrination. But there's also a bird, the peregrine. And for the Celts, they often associated the Holy Spirit with the wild hawk as much as they did the gentle dove. So I will go out into the very forest in August that I had this experience with six people, and we will go through a 4-day and 4-night fast, but absolutely held in the fundament of the Christian gospel-heavy experience. So, yeah, I do still do it.
Wow. And presumably it's the sort of thing you'd recommend other people try. What should I be aware of before I attempt such things?
Don't do it on your own, for goodness sake, because what happens is so complex and profound, you need a professional around you. Don't expect you're going to have some big psychotropic visionary thing. You probably won't. But do pay attention if there's just a yearning in you to go, I'd really like to know, what do I feel and look like after a few days alone in an ancient English forest?
And if the idea of being alone for a few days with no technology,
yeah,
if that scares me, that's presumably a sign I might need to consider it, because it's supposed to be daunting.
Yes, it's not a macho thing, but a little unease in the way you're describing is actually it's a sign that you're healthy. It's the people that have blank eyes and go, yeah, I'm going to do it, and they don't think it through. It is unnerving to remove your watch, to have no phone. It doesn't exist in that category of experience. It's something quite outside of it. But as Christians, it's something that the Desert Fathers knew all about, and the Desert Mothers, and the early Celtic Christians, the early Irish, and, you know, even where I live in the far west. So there is a, you know, there's an ancestral connection and lineage to this.
Yeah, and what do you think they were aware of that maybe we as Christians aren't always aware of in terms of why you would even want to do something like this?
A lot happened when Christianity became the state religion. There's always something, you know, a lot of people do wonder. We sometimes wonder, think, Christians are sometimes at their best when they're a little marginalised,
yeah,
and they're under pressure, you know, no pressure, no diamond. And the evolution of the Desert Fathers and Mothers is a response, actually, to some Christians who'd been little more than outlaws for several hundred years, going, do you know what? There's a potential inertia in the fact that we're now respectable and we are the state religion of Rome, which was a place seen as unutterably corrupted. And so what they wanted to do even then was to go out and be alone with God and to see what God wanted for them and to talk to them. And what is interesting is in Irish Christianity, the influence is less Latinized and much more Coptic and much more Egyptian. You look at the stone crosses everywhere and it's got St. Anthony on them, not St. Patrick. And so what comes out of that, and especially in the Irish experience, it's less miserable asceticism. It's less starving yourself and, you know, walloping yourself with a nettle over your shoulder. It's more that typical Celtic exuberation of God's "it is good, it is very good" creation.
Tell me more about prayer. I think there's a whole chapter on it in the book. How does your prayer life look different today to when you were a teenager? What have you learnt about prayer?
The way that I pray now is probably not quite as spontaneously as my evangelical youth. So I prayed quite a bit when I was, because I was just around it all the time. You know, here I am. And I like all of that, and I'll still do it. But the thing that I now have kind of, I live in the calligraphy of something called the Jesus Prayer, which is always moving around in my heart. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Very simple thing, but it has a kind of a power. In Orthodoxy, you're always trying to be in the domain, interestingly, of your heart rather than your head. And that is a prayer that can circle almost like blood round your body. So I'm less of a spontaneous prayer, although I will do it, certainly, and I see no harm in it. But I'm more probably locked into some of the Psalms. And I suppose, you know what? I think I end up singing my prayers a lot more because I was in the choir as a catechumen. So I tend to sing when I'm praying.
Mm, lovely. How would you describe your calling?
Well, God loves an outlaw. And I think I'm a kind of spy for Christ in a way. I don't think I'm ever going to be terribly respectable. I think it'd probably be a disaster if I became a bishop, but you never know. You never know. I'm only 54. But I hope that I can be reasonably authentic. And my deepest wish for Liturgies of the Wild is to encourage, you know, people tend to think, oh, well, I don't think I'm going to be able to explore the Bible. I don't think I'm a priest, but I also don't think I'm Jordan Peterson. Is there another way I can do this? And I'm saying, yeah, there is another amazing ancient way. It's not as if the early Christians, when they arrived in England as missionaries, they didn't turn up with lots of huge books that they handed out. They turned out as storytellers. It was the most compelling, strangest story of this exotic Middle Eastern cult of personality called Christianity. And so I'm just trying to encourage people to, wouldn't it be incredible for a generation of storytellers to arise from this? However, in the broader sense of what storytelling means, but these are the image I keep using for people because they can just about remember it, is remember at the end of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, remember all the frozen animals that Aslan puts his holy breath on, the Ruach. Well, these stories are our inheritance, and for many of us, I'm afraid they're very frozen. And the book is a love letter to opening them up again and getting in touch with your own Aslan self and telling some of these stories.
That's a really beautiful place to finish it. I'm so sorry we're out of time, but Martin Shaw, it's been an absolute pleasure. Liturgies of the Wild, Myths That Make Us, a New York Times bestseller, is available now wherever you get your books from, and I can highly recommend it. But Dr. Martin Shaw, thank you so much for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you. A pleasure.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.